What's happening, people? Welcome to the Football Fans Podcast, The Face Off. Myself, Jordan Jarrett, Brian, you know how we do by now. Hope you're all well. We're doing these nostalgic look backs on iconic Premier League games over the 20 plus years of the Premier League's existence. We've been away for a couple of weeks because I've been busy. I just want to lie and think of something really kind of smart then, but I've been busy. It's the honest answer then, really.
Busy during lockdown, Jord.
Yeah, listen, you know what's weird, G? I'm actually busier now than before.
Yep.
It's crazy.
Do you know what I mean? I'm actually busy now, so it's all good. So now, on the show this week, we've got one of the most iconic games, arguably the most iconic game of the Premier League era. We're going back to 1996 at Anfield, Liverpool versus Newcastle. And to do this one, we have a Liverpool supporter from the Anfield rap, Neil Axon. How are you doing, Neil?
Very well indeed, Jordan. Very, very well.
Good man, good man. Cheers for coming back on the show. And making his debut on the pod, we've got Bob from the Magpie Channel. We've got Keg. What's happening, sir?
How you doing? I'm very well, thank you. Eagerly anticipating some big news.
Well, we'll see about that. We'll see about that. Mike Ashley ain't going without. He ain't going without a fight. So we'll see how that goes. And I'm playing neutral on this week's pod. We've got our Chelsea fan Gabriel. What are you saying, G?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Really looking forward to this episode. Probably it is my favourite game, so we really enjoy talking about it.
All right, so you know what? Let me start with you, Keg, as it's your first time on. Although you lost this fixture 4-3, would you say that this is the most iconic Premier League fixture, or do you think that Man City's title win against QPR, considering what that resulted in, pips this fixture?
It could do. Like, this is definitely one of the most iconic games, whether you want to rank it number one or not. It's definitely within the top five, I would say. It was just end-to-end, seven goals, a lot of action, a lot at stake, both gunning for the Premier League title. But, I don't know, you could maybe put the Man City game up there. There wasn't as many goals. Or was it? What was that score to? What was that?
3-2.
3-2, yeah. So, yeah, not as many goals. I remember Joey Barton was sent off for sticking the nut on Balotelli, I think it was. But I don't know. I'd probably say that game, like, it was the commentary, the Aguero chant. So I'm just not wanting to say this game because we lose. you might have different opinions. Personally, I didn't enjoy this game. this game cost us the Premier League title, so I'm not a fan, to be honest.
So let's get into this. Okay, what are your memories of this fixture? It finished 4-3. You know, it was a good old-fashioned ding-dong. Two teams that were going for the title. I think a lot of people seem to forget that Liverpool actually were in the title race, albeit a bit loosely as well. People seem to kind of remember United, Newcastle, and Man United going for the title, but Liverpool were kind of hanging on, in, you know, as a third team as well. What are your memories of... whatever. What are your memories, Keg, of this particular fixture?
At the time... Not a lot, to be honest, because I was a little bit young at that time. Like, I don't really remember a great lot about this game, but it's in history. Like, this season as a whole, as a Newcastle fan, we all remember this season kind of fondly, but also we also kind of want to put it at the back of our minds. Like, we were 12 points clear in the league at one point. We were the favourites to lift the title, but this was one of the few games that sent us on a bad run that ended up costing us the title. So, we kind of look on it fondly, but at the same time, it's very bittersweet. If we won this game, I think we believe we would have went on to win the title. I think this game absolutely cost us in the end. I think someone from the team said, I think it might have been Kevin Keegan or someone, said a few years later that he looks back on this game and regrets not winning it because it ultimately cost us the title.
I agree with that. I agree with that indeed. Yeah. Neil... David James, he had a bit of a shocker in this game from what I remember looking back on the highlights of this game. Two goals, that one, the Ferdinand goal goes right through his hand and it wasn't even, you know, hit that hard. And the Asprilla goal, I don't know where he is, coming out of his box, he gets done. Does David James make your top five Premier League goalkeepers?
Sorry, what? No.
No, what Liverpool's. Liverpool's.
Liverpool's top five Premier League goalkeepers. Good Lord, I thought you meant that, like, in general there.
Oh, no. Come on.
No, it doesn't even, I mean, I don't know. It depends. I'm trying to work out how many goalkeepers we've had. There's the current fella. He's great. There's Reina. So he's very emphatically in there. And then you sort of do struggle a little bit. I mean, it's been a problem. It's been on and off a problem position for us. So, I mean, he may make it in at number five by default. But he was, you know, he was dreadful for us, James. Absolutely dreadful for us. You know, I think he'd at times bit of it quite harsh, and I think that some of the commentary around him is a little harsh in places. But ultimately, you know, when it counted, David James was nowhere to be seen from a Liverpool point of view this season and the season that followed. And I think that's, if there's a thing you want from your goalkeeper, it's to feel as though he's there for you when you need him. But this season and the season that follows, you know, Liverpool are around title races, and it's often David James being frankly dreadful that does for us. Now, in both instances, I think we were always an attacker light, which always surprises people, but we were. And so I think that's a little an impact as well. And there's still questions over the shape and what was going on at the centre of defence and the centre of midfield, getting control. But David James does not help matters, far from it. And this game's a great example. What on earth does he think he's doing for Aspreas? It's genuinely befuddling where he ends up and what he ends up doing. It's crazy stuff. He basically is one-on-one with him. Eventually, I think he ends up 30 yards from his own goal and still seemingly tries to use his hands. It's absolutely bananas. And it's worth remembering that goal put Newcastle 3-2 up. It's only because Colley Moore gets him out of jail, but it's not remembered as a David James howler.
That's true. That particular goal, the Espirito goal, where he comes out of his he comes rushing out so far. It reminds me a little bit of Szczesny when he was at Arsenal. And one of my criticisms against him, and I think there's similarities in David James as well, is they're the sort of goalkeepers that feel they need to always be involved. They need to always be doing something. And invariably, for me, the best goalkeepers are the ones that are just happy to be on their line and stopping the ball going in the box. They don't feel the need to always be involved and coming out their line and, do you know what I mean, sweeping up. And that goal definitely reminds me of that type of goalkeeper that just wants to be involved when, mate, you didn't really need to come out your line. We were covered.
I mean, our offside line was terrible for that as well. I mean,
it wasn't great.
No, it's mad. I think there's 5 yards between centre-half to like a join the dots puzzle.
It was bad. It was bad. Something else, though, that came from that game that stuck out, it reminded me how good Stan Collymore's striker was. And I always liked Stan Collymore anyway as a striker. I always thought he was like a poor man's Batistuta. That's a compliment in a way. He kind of had everything. He could head the ball. He was powerful. He was quick. He kind of was two-footed. He scored obviously two crucial goals in that game as well. How is Collymore? Does that game in itself keep a soft spot in the hearts of Liverpool fans just on that game alone? Or is his general demeanour and career seen as a bit of a meh amongst Liverpool supporters?
Just a little bit of a shame, because I think the thing everyone sort of agrees with the scope of his talent and his prowess. You know, he had everything you need to play number nine. So I think that Colley Moore's viewed generally by the, you know, insofar as you can speak for any large group of people, he's viewed as just a little bit of a shame as a Liverpool player, because I don't think there's you know, no one's knocking around feeling as though he wasn't the complete package, because he was. You know, I think he's tremendously gifted and also a good team player for a couple of seasons in there. You know, I think that Fowler and Colley Moore do link up pretty well. Mm. When I watched that game back, I watched it back on its anniversary this year because of lockdown stuff and all of that. The player who I took away, as I maintain, he is arguably the most underrated Liverpool player and one of the three most underrated English footballers I can conceive of, certainly from the modern era, is Steve McManaman. He is absolutely unplayable on this day. He runs for 90 minutes. He's quicker than anyone else. He runs stronger and faster than anyone else. He wins the ball back on occasions, but is bringing people into play, is reading of the game. He's absolutely unplayable. He's phenomenal, McManaman, in this. And he's just a tremendous talent. And in the firmament of Liverpool greats, you know, he's very rarely comes up. He's very rarely discussed. He's had a good lockdown, McManaman, because people have been watching old stuff and I've seen a bit more chat about him. But, you know, insofar as thinking of footballers who could have worked in any era, McManaman, of all the, you know, there's a lot of, oh, what's your all-time Liverpool 11 at the moment, or which player from X would you put into the current Liverpool side, the one that's won 27 out of 29 games? And the nearest one to a correct answer is Steve McManaman. It's not Robbie Fowler, who's loved, rightly, on Merseyside because of all the goals he scored from Toxteth, all the stuff around Robbie. But Robbie wouldn't get in this side. I think he'd be close to Firmino, but he wouldn't get in. McManaman would get in. McManaman would be unbelievable in this team that we've got now. He is phenomenal, and you get to see it in this game. He is the driving force from a Liverpool point of view in this game. He's brilliant.
He's funny. Did
did he talk bad about Liverpool when he went to Real Madrid or whatever?
Nobody went on a free. After that. He went on a free, and he was the first Liverpool player to leave on a free. But even that was, you know, the McManaman's book's great. It's one of the best autobiographies or memoir of a footballer. And in his book, he says that basically at this point, and this is no criticism of the other player I'm going to mention, but Liverpool buy McAteer, and McAteer's put on 28 grand a week, and McManaman never got more than 6 grand a week out of Liverpool. They wouldn't give him another deal, and they were trying to play on his loyalty. And then the year before he goes, they accept an offer from Barcelona when he doesn't want to go, but they say that we've accepted the offer, we want you to go. So he goes all the way to Barcelona. He's actually used to make a point so that Barcelona can sign Rivaldo, which goes over pretty well for him. But then he's only got a year left, and Liverpool make a pretty desultory offer to him. So he leaves on a free and he goes to Madrid. And when he goes to Madrid, you know, he wins two European Cups. He's man of the match in a Champions League final, scores and is man of the match in a Champions League final, McManaman. Because he was just brilliant at football. But what sours him from a Liverpool point of view is he was our first Bosman sort of kick in the pants. You know, he was the first one where Owen's got a bit of that as well, where Owen ran his contract down. He had 1 year left, so he felt we had to cash in. And so he was the first time that. And so that I think that is one of the reasons why he soured on Liverpool. But also the other problem is that he just doesn't have the medals. You want to talk about great Liverpool players, the lads in the 80s won 4 league titles, European Cup, FA Cup winners medals. McManaman gets an FA Cup winners medal. He's man of the match in the 92 FA Cup final where we beat Sunderland. And he's man of the match when we beat Bolton in the FA Cup final in 94, but he doesn't play that well against United in 96.
Mm, I hear that. Mm. It's funny, G, that, that Neil mentions the comparison. He mentions McManaman as really good at beating people, was quite quick. I never thought of McManaman as necessarily quick. I compare him to Robert Pires, who wasn't quick, but just had this real interesting knack of beating people one-on-one almost every single time. And it wasn't through, they weren't like Kanchelskis or Ryan Giggs or out-and-out Overmars, but they just had this real great... Yeah, Ginola even. They had this real great ball control and ability just to drop a shoulder and beat you every time. But on Newcastle now, I know you're a secret Newcastle fan deep down, G. it is, as Keg says, literally that game in itself defined the next, I think, 15 years for Newcastle, because if they win that game, they probably win the title and then Newcastle could be a big club. I know they say they're a big club, but they're not. But they could be a big club. But they didn't. And then we've seen since then 2 relegations and they've kind of fluttered in the bottom half of the league at best. Looking back on it now, do you think that they would, and I'll ask Keg this in a second, exchange the entertaining football they had for less boring football that might have resulted in results that won them a title?
You'd say, I'd say no, because they wouldn't have got to the position they were in without that entertaining football. You know, sure, then you could say you could do a Jose Mourinho and get to a certain point and like, you know.
That's it. Right, 10 men behind the ball. We've got 4 games left. They ain't scoring no goals, master.
That's it. We're 12 points clear now. Let the other team chase us. But actually, like, no, I don't think that was in Keegan's DNA. I don't think it was in the DNA of the other players that were there. And I think if they'd have tried to do that, it probably would end up worse. And I think it's that, and Fergie was great with the mind games that season in particular. And like, he kind of had this thing where, you know, he almost, Man United in their early title in the Premier League era, kind of used to have the first couple of months off. And then kind of really build up a big head of steam. And they went on a really ruthless run. Any other year, they win the league and they win it in style. So I say no. I mean, I'm not really one for going back and changing the past anyway. But I do think there is something about that Newcastle team that will always be remembered. I know it sounds patronising.
Very patronising, but we get what you mean.
Because it's because, you know, nothing came out of it and winning it. But it's a reason why... People love that Premier League era, and people may have a soft spot for Newcastle in that sense.
Did you agree, Keg? If you could exchange the entertainer's tag for something like a Chelsea, for example, and just, you know, not really fun to watch week in, week out, but you get the job done, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0. Would you swap the entertainment for the results in that final part of the season?
It would have been a good option, kind of like Mourinho, just to park the bus. Like, we were 12 points ahead. We should have kind of looked at it as Stevie G once said, don't let this slip. Like, well, that's all we had to do. We just had to just keep that momentum and just did everything within our power to win that game, because, as you said, that defined our next 15, 20 years, and we're still reaching for that. Like, that's where we peaked, really. So it's a shame that it came to that. But as Gabriel said, nah, like, we were the entertainers. That wasn't the way Keegan liked to play. That was the best era of our history, probably. Like, them few players in that squad, even the season afterwards, that season didn't even involve Alan Shearer. So that they were the entertainers. That's what Keegan set out to do. He tried to entertain. He wanted to bring sexy football. And that's what he did. That, I don't think parking the bus and having 10 men behind the ball was what we wanted to do. That's not what we wanted to see. We wanted to see good football, and that's what we had. It's unfortunate that we can't look back on it now and say we have at least one Premier League title. But yeah, we played the right way. It's just a shame that we didn't come away with the title.
I think it's a bit of a myth, to be honest with you, Jordan. I mean, if you just look at the raw numbers, and it is just raw numbers, Newcastle play great stuff, but they, you know, that season, they, you know, in total, only concede two more than Manchester United who win the title.
Yeah.
They actually don't score as many goals as Liverpool over the course of the season. You know, Newcastle's issue was just an ever so slightly in comparison to Manchester United in the era, slight soft underbelly away from home.
I was going to ask you, Neil, do you think that Newcastle, it's one of those real Sky Sports questions, but do you think that Newcastle lost the league because of their lack of experience in that time? Or do you think that, as G says, United just were kind of becoming that team that in the latter laps of a race just knew how to, you know, churn out six wins in seven?
I think that United... Yeah, I think United were able to better pace, but it's worth remembering the season before, Manchester United lose the league on the last day when Liverpool beat Blackburn.
True.
And United don't get over the line against West Ham. Liverpool beat Blackburn and United don't beat West Ham. I think that it's a United side. When you look at the squads, and you can throw Liverpool into this as well, United have just got a tiny little bit more strength and depth in all parts of the pitch. Newcastle were a really good... There's a reason why Keegan, and it's much discussed retrospectively, Keegan signing Asprilla. But one of the reasons Keegan signs Asprilla is he just doesn't quite feel like he's got enough good players. He literally could just do with another really good footballer and one's presented to him. And that's why he chooses to do what he does. And ultimately, I think it's a United side that right the way through this decade, you know, you can look at each season. And you can say it's staying power, and you can say it's nous, and you can say it's mind games. But I think a lot of the time it's just having two, three more good players and them carrying you through. Because there's no rhyme or reason to why United, a couple of seasons on, finished second to Arsenal, who haven't won anything for ages. Arsenal only gets 78 points. United finished second to Arsenal with 77. You know, they've been better in seasons gone by. And it's, you know... What we often do is we decide to ascribe certain values to certain football teams, and sometimes that's really, really fair, but sometimes literally just having one or two more good players than your opponents is what carries you over the line. And I think that you can see that through this period. United had such a squad, and that is massively to do with what is the youth players, because they get injected with six or seven really, really strong talents, plus are the richest club period, and are able to invest. So they've got this natural boost of this six or seven great players, and then they're also able to compete with anybody in the market as they go and add to that squad. And there's even one or two still coming through around this period, you know, a Wes Brown or a John O'Shea are just slowly but surely emerging, and Darren Fletcher adding to this squad. So I think that's what underpins United's dominance, that they've got a great manager in Ferguson, and they're just able to just outlast you, just go one more round.
I hear that. Keg, is it a myth that we hear that, you know, Newcastle fans, we all want to win. We're in sport to win, obviously, as a given. But is it a myth that Newcastle fans want to be a club that becomes serial winners and think they should be a winning side? Or are the Newcastle fans, do they just want some good football? And is their main gripe in this last decade, I suppose, the fact that, not that we're not winning, it's that the football is just dire?
Yeah, it's a huge myth that we demand success. And like, I've heard that from various other fans. Like we've always said, we don't demand success. We demand a team that tries, because particularly over this Mike Ashley era, we've had underachieving players that don't really deserve to wear the shirt, managers or coaches that aren't good enough, like John Carver and Joe Kinnear. Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, we went from the Keegan and the Bobby Robson era to 13 years of the Mike Ashley era. Like, we went from, like, even our greatest era, we didn't win anything, but we were up there, we were competing, we were in the top four. We went to back-to-back FA Cup finals in 98 and 99. We beat Barcelona at home in the Champions League. We beat Inter Milan away. Like, we just want to kind of be around about there. Like, if we got back into the top 10, top 8, top 6, that would be good enough for us, as long as there's progression. And I know we're going to talk about the takeover soon. Like, that's the initial attraction, what we want. I know a lot of people are thinking that we're going to want Premier League titles and Champions League titles within the first couple of years. That's not true at all.
Like, yeah, you say that now, but when they start signing, you know, yeah, Kai Havertz, and
if it gets there, then it'll be great. Obviously, you know what I mean. But like, we've come from where we've been, like two relegations, just to be backed as a consistent top 10, top 8 side. That would be fantastic. This season's the first time we've got past the fourth round of the FA Cup in the Mike Ashley era. Like, just cup runs. European Cup competitions, whether it's the Europa League or Champions League, like, that's just what we want. We just want players deserving of wearing the shirt who's going to push us to the top six. Like, even if it means not winning anything, it's still progression. It's still better than what we've put up with for the last 10, 15 years.
Looking back on that game, Keg, and that season and even era, who is your favourite player from that Newcastle team? And was there a player in that team also that you felt was underrated, didn't get the kind of credit or attention that he deserved?
Yeah, I think particularly of that year, obviously, because as I said before, Shearer wasn't a part of that squad yet. It's got to be Ginola. I think Ginola's my favourite player, but also he's kind of underrated. I know he's very, very highly rated, but I don't think he's rated high enough. I think the player he was back then, he was absolutely fantastic what he could do with the ball. He was a bit like Messi when he was dribbling. Like, he was so, he didn't really look that quick, but he had a bit of pace about him. Very close control, able to beat defenders with just a little dink of the shoulder. He was very, very good, could score from long range. He was absolutely fantastic. But in terms of underrated players, I would probably have to say Tino Asprea. And I think just in this quarantine, like, yeah, I've realised myself how good of a player Tino Asprea actually was. Because this era, I was a kid. Like, I can't remember it that well. Like, for me, Tino's legacy kind of lives on through his hat-trick against Barcelona in the Champions League. Like, when you hear Tino Asprea's name, that's all you really think of, that hat-trick. Like, that was his defining moment. But during quarantine, I've been looking back on old games, even Premier League games that we forgot about. I think I've seen a win against Sheffield Wednesday or someone. A couple of other games, like this game, the Liverpool game. He wasn't incredible player, and I didn't actually realize how good he was. He was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, so I think he's one of our probably most underrated players of all time.
I think they just blamed Asprea for
unsettling the team.
Yeah, and like, we have to play differently now, so then the team is not there. And I think it was purely coincidental. Like, he was a player, you know, they just talk about players that, you know, you pay your admission for. He was that entertainment value, and he scored in this game, which, if Newcastle defended properly, could have been the winning goal. You know? And then the perception of it is totally different, but because they lost, I loved Asprea, and he was a part of the reason I wanted
Newcastle to support Newcastle.
I wanted Newcastle to win that year, because I was like, I don't want this now to all be blamed on him, you know what I mean? I wanted them to win on that basis of that. And of the hate for Man United, because of everyone in the playground.
Of course, yeah, of course. Did Newcastle deserve to... Go on, Neil.
Ferdinand was brilliant. He was just incredible. Played for Liverpool. Yeah. He was an incredible footballer. You know, it's worth remembering that when he moves from Newcastle to Tottenham, he's 30. At that point, Newcastle very much get his best years, get his core years. He was an incredible player.
No, he was. I think he was quite underrated, actually.
Very much so.
Striker, you know. Did Liverpool finally deserve to win that game? Did the better team, did the deserving team win that fixture?
The funny thing is, at the time, when I was watching it, because I wanted United to lose so badly, in my mind, I told myself that Newcastle were the better team. But when I look at the stats now and I watch the game again, I'm looking at it and I think probably Liverpool probably just about shaded it.
Okay, all right. And of course, there was a less famous 4-3 win for Liverpool again the following year that I was saying just before we started recording was an awful game. I don't know if briefly, Neil, you remember. I thought for a game of 7 goals, I actually remember that game more than the first one. I remember it being really bad. Do you remember that one, Neil?
Yeah, it's a terrible game of football. The first 4-3 is, it's got with one or two errors. The Newcastle are the better side first half by some distance. Liverpool are the better side second half, the first 4-3. But both are playing good stuff. And yes, there's some mistakes in there that lead to goals, like James has discussed. But it's a good side with two good sides, both playing progressive, creative football. The following season's 4-3 is two sides that genuinely, it's like watching drunks play. And it just ends up being 4-3. You know what I mean? Like Liverpool win it 4-3, and it's, I think we race into that lead, and it's like Newcastle are almost on the verge of kicking it into the goal for us. But that's fine because we're on the verge of kicking it in the goal for them. So it's like some sort, like it's like a terrible karaoke version of the previous year's game. Yeah,
it was so bad. It was so, so bad. Okay, let's now pick up with some news of the day. It's been announced in the last hour or so that the Premier League will be resuming on the 17th of June. That's still to be confirmed by the actual Premier League, but the BBC and Sky are reporting it currently, so we'll go with it for now. Let me start with you, because I know you didn't want to stop, so I'll come to you. I'll come to you first. Is your thinking still the same? Are you still of the mindset that bring it back? Let's go. Or we changed your view in any way in the last week or two?
I think over the last few weeks, I'd kind of resigned myself to thinking that it probably wasn't going to come back. It's kind of like sometimes where your parents have an argument in a room and they come out, they sort it out. You never knew the argument was happening, so you didn't know what's happening through it. I kind of feel like the Premier League kind of aired its dirty laundry out with all of that, the different scenarios and all that type of stuff. Which I guess there was public interest in it, but all of the things that had happened in there made me feel like this is putting me off. I felt there was a lot of agendaism to it, rather you know, come back but with no relegation and all these type of silly things, which I thought were ridiculous. And in the end, I was thinking, all right, well, if it's that complex to bring it back, just don't worry about it, just leave it, just cancel it and give it to Liverpool. I am kind of glad it's coming back now, although not as much as it would have been like 6 weeks ago. There have been a few things in the mix of this which have kind of, I guess, poured cold water on my excitement of it coming back. And I'm still a few questions that unanswered, such as what happens if there's a breakout in a club, and you know, will it get cancelled at that point if that happens as well? So I guess I'm cautiously optimistic about it going well, but I'm not quite convinced just because of all the things that I've heard behind the scenes and Troy Deeney and Kante and all those type of things.
I hear you. Neil, last time you were on, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, please, but you were saying just get it done. You're kind of bored of it now and you want to just get a decision and let's go. What's your reaction? I mean, if we put to one side the fact that you're a Liverpool supporter, and this will now mean Liverpool will be crowned the champions at some point this season. What's your general thoughts on the decision to bring it back?
I mean, we were crowned champions as soon as they said that they were going to end it all on sport and merit. So if it was going to go to points per game, then obviously it was all done and dusted.
True.
The idea of the champions thing is almost, you know, it's getting to watch them again, which I'm looking forward to. I think they had to do everything they could to bring it back, because league seasons need to follow one another. And I think that, you know, listen, it's not like it happened with 3 games gone or anything like that. You know, all the stuff around restarts, I've felt all the way through, you need to have that continuity. You need it right the way through. You need it for the full division. I think points per game is remarkable, would have been would have felt unfair. I think weighted points per game would have led to a lot of arguments about the weighting. Sure. We all know the end of seasons are weird anyway. You know, if you play a side, you know, we've all had the conversation that you can play a side and they're on the beach. But then there's the flip side of playing a side that are on the beach sometimes where they play very devil may care because the result doesn't matter and suddenly they play better stuff. So there will be a bit of oddness in it now regardless, but there would be anyway. And I think that's really important. There's loads of people who've got hooked in on fairness. There's loads of bits of football that is just a bit unfair sometimes. Always has been, you know, it doesn't even itself out over the course of a season. That's a lie. All this stuff's always been there or thereabouts. The best thing you can do is just get 38 games played. And then everyone's got 38 games played and then you've just got to go sound. You know, there's been seasons in the past where loads of games have been postponed because of the weather. And then they all get played in a run. You just put up with it and you've got to be able to cope. And ultimately it is a game. The big problem still remains that relegation hits so hard and will hit so hard in this new economic climate. But then that's a thing of the Premier League's making for 15 years. That's nothing new. It's just more pronounced now than ever. And it's, you know, the big problem is the Championship is this massive thing where there's a big cliff going one way, Premier League into the Championship, that feels like it kills teams. And it's a massive cliff to clamber League One into the Championship. It's the Championship that's a big problem because of the way in which it's beat. And that's the creation of the Premier League. So, but they've got to play and there's got to be agreed relegation and got to be agreed promotion. And then everyone's just got to get on so that we can, you know, next season's going to start behind closed doors. I'll be amazed if it doesn't. We've almost just got to do everything we can to get as much of football as possible through this in one piece to the start of the 2021-2022 season. That's what we're in this for. We're not just in this for anything short term.
Keg, are you in agreement with G in that it returning, you're at the point now where, you know what, you're just... this last 8 or 9, 10 games, whatever it is, your excitement for those games is just a little bit dampened now. You're like, you know what? Just get the games played and let's move on. Or are you actually quite excited about the remaining fixtures of the season?
A little bit of both, yeah. I think we've got to be excited because we're here because we're football fans. We love football. We want to watch it. We want to see our team, whether it's on TV because it's behind closed doors or whether we're at the stadium. It doesn't really matter. Like, we support our teams and not just our team, but football in general. We just want to see some competition. We want to see some competitive football. So, I think we should all be excited that it's coming back, but it is a little bit bittersweet. Like, it's been gone for so long. It's been stopped because of this horrendous thing that's taken over the world. And I don't know. It's a difficult situation. I don't think, personally, this country's ready for football to come back. Like,
well, you know what? I should have actually started by asking you. I mean, without knowing your politics, are you the sort of person that trusts the government's guidelines in advising that the Premier League can and should bring back football? Do you think there are ulterior motives to bringing back the Premier League? Or, I'm assuming that you are a bit sceptical there as based on what you've just said.
Yeah, like I say, I don't think we're ready. There's still been players, I think there's been a few more confirmed today. There's still cases of players and coaches in the Premier League. So I don't think we can bring football back until everybody's back to full fitness and we know that this thing isn't going to contaminate more people.
To be fair, I'm in the camp that I think it's too early as well. But but in that sense, that means that you're never going to get football back until there's a vaccine.
Yeah.
So then if effectively you're looking at then no football for possibly a year. So the numbers, to be fair, are relatively low in considering who the amount of people have tested positive. The numbers are low. I'm not for football returning yet, but the numbers are not particularly high. So if we go on the basis that the numbers are really, really low, maybe this is the safest it's going to be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Like I say, it's very bittersweet. Like, I think we do have to continue it. As Neil said, it kind of just needs to... we need to kind of just wrap it up. Like, we need to get this season over with. I think, like, Liverpool need to win the title. Norwich need to try and survive relegation. We don't just want to either scrap it completely, but we don't just want to force people into doing things. Like, we don't just want to relegate Norwich and give Liverpool the title without completing the full season. Like, how many games are we on? We're about 31 games. Like, it's not a full season. Like, I can't commemorate... West Brom, because I think they said last week that they want to continue the season. Like they're on the verge of promotion. If we cancelled the season, then they probably would have got automatic promotion. But they said, nah, we want to continue. We want to earn that promotion. which I think is great for them because they don't have to do that. Like, they could just say, cancel the season and promote her. But they want to earn that, which is, I think, is great.
See, Neil, my biggest issue is this. It's not so much the issue of the safety anymore. It's the lack of fans in the ground. Now, you're probably getting to know me quite well, and G will definitely know. I'm turning into a bit of a miserable so-and-so. So I've not been watching the Bundesliga games. I watched one because I had to for work. But I'm really struggling with the idea of being excited by football games without supporters. I really am. And as you said, I can't see supporters in any kind of sporting arena until next summer. I'll be surprised if any stadium has fans in it between now and next spring or summer. I also sense a lot of people, Neil, almost forcing themselves or lying to themselves that the Bundesliga, oh yeah, that German game, you know what? It wasn't that bad, you know? No. I'm not going to force myself to pretend like I liked the game when it clearly wasn't the spectacle that it should be. And the way that I kind of explain it, how I see it to some people, is this. Neil, what's your favourite dinner? What's your favourite dish?
I don't know. I'm suddenly very on the spot. let's just say something Italian, something pastry. Go on.
Right. Okay. Spag bowl. Right. So if I make you the best spag bowl, and I prepare it for you for dinner, great.
Yeah.
I put it on a plate. I come to you at the table, but en route to walking to you, I trip up and I drop the plate on the floor, and I scurry all the pasta and the bolognese back on the plate and hand it to you. Are you going to eat it?
Have I seen you fall over, or are you lying to me?
No, you've seen me. You've seen me fall over. It's on the floor, but I'll put it back onto the plate and I'll come to you.
Well, no, I'm probably not, because I don't know what the floor's like. I mean, there, that's ridiculous. Got... this.
So my
quite stands as a metaphor. Well, who's the trip?
The metaphor is it. The metaphor being that I can't accept a product that isn't what I love about that product. I'm not going to, but I can't watch football without fans. And as much as we all love football, I just wonder if people are forcing themselves to tell themselves it's not that bad, when actually I think it's horrific.
Well, I'm miserable. I've watched three Bundesliga games, and the first one, two Leverkusen and one was Dortmund Bayern. The second Leverkusen game, the game between Leverkusen and Gladbach, was really good. It was just a really good game of football between two quite evenly matched sides, and I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it for what it was, which was a good game of football between two quite evenly matched sides. And I think that camera work's a little bit of a thing here. The one thing you don't want to see is tons and tons of empty seats. You don't want to be reminded of it. But I enjoyed that. I saw Dortmund versus Schalke. It was terrible. But that was mainly because Schalke were dreadful. So, you know, Schalke offered very little resistance.
Sorry to cut you there, Nils. That's interesting, because I think the opposite. I think as a football game, I know Schalke weren't good enough, but I thought it was a decent football game. But for me, the spectacle was just, I couldn't watch it for the whole 90.
Yeah, I struggled with it. And I might have been part being a spectacle, but I just thought it was a bad match. I thought Schalke were just really, really poor. But I enjoyed the Leverkusen games. I think in general, though, football on the whole is a bit shit. And we try to convince ourselves that that's not the case for a number of reasons. But there are a lot of football matches that you go to, and there could be 100,000 people in attendance, and they still wouldn't be very good. And ultimately, if you want to find a football match not particularly good, then you can do that, because there's a lot of them that go on that just go that way. You know, we remember, we've just talked about Newcastle-Liverpool, the 4-3. We remember that because it was a genuinely great game. Great games, and good games even, are rarer than you think. What makes a game, and this is, and I'll take this point, you know, I watched just before lockdown, I went out and I watched Burnley versus Tottenham. Not a game I would normally have watched, but I was with people, we were having a nice time. The crowd, the noise was great. Burnley were up. And also, it was nice to watch Burnley bloody Tottenham's nose in the first half where they played them off the park. The point about that, though, is I enjoyed that emotional aspect. I quite enjoyed a Burnley side who were accidentally at the same holiday resort as me over the summer. So the good lads beating this Tottenham side, when I quite like watching Mourinho get beat. Whereas I've got literally no skin in the game when Union play Wolfsburg. Like, I can't even begin to convince myself as to what that's actually about. So I think that it's about that, really. And I think it'll be a little bit different for the Premier League. Will it be as good? No. But I'm not worried about these nine games. What I'm genuinely worried about, football, I see it in our numbers at the Anfield Wrap, and I've been told it's in other people's numbers, and by other people's, I mean big companies. Football has a lull. As autumn turns to winter, people are less interested in football. When the end of the season feels so far away, when the new players are no longer as new and shiny, when, you know, when the nights are drawing in and it's dark and it's dank, football suffers a dip. And I'm worried for the game behind closed doors at the end of November. That's when I'm worried about it. That's when I think it might be difficult to summon up the enthusiasm when we're all 10 games in and no one's got, you know, you're not on the verge of silverware or settling the season's ups and downs. That's when I think it might be difficult to summon up the enthusiasm. I think these 9 games will feel a bit like a mad World Cup that's played in the middle of nowhere, and we'll all get into it. And as they come, you'll feel part of it. And the FA Cup will be a laugh as well. And if they do the Champions League, that'll be a laugh and we'll all enjoy that. But what exactly how we're watching Burnley versus Southampton on the Saturday, on the 29th of November, when, you know, both sides look mid-table fodder, that's when I think it's really going to struggle and it's really going to be hard and all the novelty's worn off.
Gee, I know you've got to run now, but in 30 seconds, and I'll let you go, does the no fans thing give an opportunity for people like me to actually just focus on the games? A colleague of mine at work was saying, okay, with no fans, it gave him an opportunity just to focus on the actual patterns of play, the tactics, all that sort of thing as well. That was his perspective, but I struggle without the fans. And I take Neil's point that next year might be hard to getting people enthused by it.
I don't think it does. Cause I think because of what Neil said in a nutshell, kind of football is not just about the technical aspects of the game. It's about the camaraderie. You might miss the mate that you sit with every week, who you don't get to sit with now. And you might miss the talking points. You know, we're on this podcast and you found other things to talk about. But actually, what gets us here every week is talking about football kind of going forward and that and the excitement of it. So it's everything else around it. It's not just the game itself. There's a lot of people who talk for hours and hours about football, but are on their phone most of the game. So the actual element of just watching the tactics and stuff, I don't think there's a lot, as Neil said, there's a lot of bad games, and I don't think there's enough good games to actually make you want to watch the tactical element of it. It's the whole package, and we need the fans back, and we need, you know, everything that goes with football around it back sooner rather than later to support the product.
I hear that. Gabriel, I'll let you go because I know you've got to run into another call. But thank you very much for coming on, G. Appreciate that.
All right, gents. Have a good day.
Cheers, man. Let's wrap up, guys, with Newcastle takeover talk. Okay, fill us in. What's the latest?
Oh, it's been a roller coaster. The latest is that, well, the same news that it has been for the last few days, the last week or so, that it's been given the green light. It should go ahead. My understanding of it is that no official announcement would have been made until they've announced the Premier League coming back. Because I think fans of other teams might look on that and say, why have the Premier League been working so hard on Newcastle and not about the rest of the Premier League? And we understand that the Premier League's bigger than Newcastle. We wouldn't ask for any special treatment. Getting the Premier League either up and running or cancelled one way or another has been the biggest priority. So now that this has been announced in the last hour or so, I think that opens up a window. So the date that we were given was the 1st of June, which is Monday. So the announcement now could be made anytime over the weekend up until Monday, now that the Premier League's finally been sorted. There's been a couple of stories gone in the last 2 days that the WHO, the World Health Organization, might try and stop it due to piracy crime or something like that. I think they own an illegal streaming service in Saudi Arabia. So the World Health Organization aren't against the human rights. Like, they're trying to get it cancelled because the Saudi Arabians have a bad record with human rights. But as far as I understand, the Premier League aren't going to turn it down. It has been given the green light. We're just waiting for the go-ahead to get it done, which should come this weekend.
What's exciting you more, Keg? The fact that Ashley will go, or the fact that you might have these billionaire... Like, I read that the guys coming in from Saudi Arabia, they're worth more than every single Premier League club combined.
Yeah. By quite a way, yeah.
By quite a way, not even close.
Yeah, well, a bit of both, but mainly just to get Mike Ashley out. Like, a year, 2 years ago, we've had all kinds of rumours. There's been a lot of interest over the last couple of years, which has excited us. Doesn't matter who it is. There was a group led by Peter Kenyon. I think Peter Kenyon and Amanda Staveley were trying to come into business to buy Newcastle.
So if I took over Newcastle tomorrow with 500 grand and took it off Mike Ashley, would you still be excited?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Like, the Peter Kenyon takeover, they couldn't afford the takeover. So if you can't afford to buy the club, how much money can you actually invest? But a lot of Newcastle fans were just still excited to get Mike Ashley out. But you kind of had to say, well, hold on a sec, because it could be the same or worse. Like, who knows? Like, Mike Ashley is a horrendous owner, but at least we're still in the Premier League. So it's great that we're still a Premier League club. I know we've had ups and downs with relegation, with no cup run, no exciting football. But we're not Sunderland, we're not Sunderland, we're not Bolton, Bury, Blackburn, like all these teams, Blackpool, sorry, that have really, really struggled. So at least we're still a Premier League club competing. But yeah, like, it is great to get Mike Ashley out, would say at any cost, but the fact that this guy has more money than he knows what to do with coming in, it's like a dream come true. Like, it couldn't be any sweeter. Like I say, we probably would have accepted Peter Kenyon that couldn't afford to buy the club. But now that this guy is coming in, who's beyond rich, it's literally an ideal scenario. Like, we couldn't have drawn up a better situation.
No, I hear you. Neil, do you think we'll be doing this podcast in 5 years' time? Or give me a percentage of chances that we'll be doing this podcast in 5 years' time and Newcastle fans will be saying, you know what? I'll take Ashley back, you know. I'll take him back.
That won't happen. I think you've got to be really, really careful in general with all ownerships, because we know the Premier League is not capable. The FA is not capable of running a fit and proper person test. Mm-hmm. There's tons of evidence of that, and Mike Ashley is actually one of those pieces of evidence that there's tons and tons of evidence that the people are buying and running football clubs who shouldn't be allowed anywhere near them. That's why Bury went to the wall. There's a really strong case there. There's cases all the way up and down the EFL around that. Again, you can dig out Sunderland as well around this conversation. But I do think that, you know, as part of that, I think that there are massive question marks over the ownership, whether or not they will invest, and so there won't be any sort of question mark around that. I'd be amazed if they don't. But that's one of the reasons why the Premier League is going to have to be really, really strong around financial fair play. Because the one thing that the game could really strongly do without right now is there being another enormous financial skew in the way in which there was after the takeover of Manchester City and the Abramovich takeover of Chelsea, both of which drove transfer fees and prices up. And right now, a lot of clubs, you know, Bournemouth can't have that in the Premier League at the moment. It would do for a number of clubs, and it would put others under massive pressure. So I think that there will be massive investments in Newcastle if this buyout goes through, and a lot of that is a good thing. And you end up in really, you know, in really conflicted territory here. But ultimately, you know, my position is that this buyout shouldn't be allowed. But then my position was also that Ashley's buyout shouldn't have been allowed, and my position is the Manchester City buyout shouldn't have been allowed, and that actually, you know, there's. So it's very, very difficult not to end up quite easily being labelled with hypocrisy around the issue for this reason. But the point is, and it strikes at the heart of football governance and what football's for, you know, we really strongly have had people running football clubs, and Ashley is an absolute 24-carat diamond example running football clubs in this country who shouldn't be. And what shouldn't be happening is attacks on Newcastle supporters who are excited about this, because as has been put over here really quite neatly, they're as excited of getting rid of a man who's drained the hope out of a football club and out of a city as they are about the people who are going to come in. Because that's what Ashley did, and that's what Ashley's done. And that's his greatest crime. You know, you want to talk about what, saying before, about what Newcastle's ambition should be or how Newcastle supporters see themselves. All every football supporter wants is to be hopeful, is to believe that tomorrow can be better than today. And when someone comes into a football club who actively stops that from being the case, you know, you want to talk about fit and proper. Those people aren't fit and proper. But there are massive issues, obviously, around human rights records, around piracy, around the very concept as to whether or not we want nation states using our football clubs as bargaining chips, as sports washing devices, as political tools for ends, which has happened all the way back from Abramovich and was probably happening before then. You know, do we want that to happen to our football clubs? And the answer to that should be no. But then we come back yet again, Jordan, and I'm very boring at the minute, as the huge question around football governance and the people who run the game and whether or not they're fit for purpose. And there's so many instances of the fit and proper test having failed right the way up and down the leagues for all amounts of money, from £1 to £500 million to the Glazers and their takeover and how they've run Manchester United, that we've got to conclude that the governance is the issue. It's certainly not Newcastle supporters by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I hear that. And just to wrap, tell us about your channel. Okay, tell us where people find it and what's going on.
Yeah, so we are the Magpie Channel. You can find us on YouTube at the Magpie Channel TV. We do fan interviews after the games. Obviously, there's not much material there at the minute. But we talk about all news. We do match previews, reviews, interview as many fans as we can just to get all fans' opinions. Like, it's not our opinion. It's not our channel. It's a fan channel. We try and include as many people as possible and just talk all things Newcastle, give all kinds of news. We do podcasts on whatever topics popular. We could do, for example, a potential lineup for next season. Just all kinds of different kind of topics all around Newcastle. And we're quite big on social media as well. We've got quite a big following on Instagram. Just search for the Magpie Channel on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.
Wicked. And of course, you know where to find the Anfield Wrap, Neil's channel, across all the social media platforms as well. Do you have a website as well, Neil, or just social media outlets?
No, the way, theanfieldwrap.com. You can go to that and there's the app. So yeah, there's loads of ways. It's boring. You'll be fine.
You've got no excuse to check out both their channels. Listen, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on the FFP this week. Do not forget to subscribe to the channel FFP. We are across all the socials, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Also subscribe to us via Audio Boom and Spotify as well. Stay well till next week. Peace.